ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From Queensland to WA, our great ocean reefs are under pressure. Scientists say significant coral death has occurred at the World Heritage listed Ningaloo Reef.
I wish I had good things to say, but unfortunately, yeah, we have seen quite a steep decline in the health of the reef since the bleaching.
While in Queensland, citizen scientists and AI are proving crucial to helping the Great Barrier Reef as research funding becomes harder to secure.
When people have seen reefs and they've seen what happens on reefs, they are the advocates for the reef as well. People fall in love with these places. You know, I have.
And dogs were banned some years ago to protect the unique wildlife of Christmas Island. But one very special chocolate Labrador remains, and she's shared by the whole community.
I hear this little voice in the distance, Shiloh, not Tanya, Shiloh. It's become a bit of a routine now in the morning to walk with Shiloh to school. We have a small crowd of kids that come along.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. It's been described by some as an underwater bushfire, a marine heatwave which turned corals on a World Heritage listed reef white. I'm not talking about the Great Barrier Reef, I'm talking about Australia's other heritage listed reef, the Ningaloo. It's a 300 kilometre reef off the coast of northwest WA, famous for whale sharks and manta rays and being one of the most biodiverse places in the world. But scientists are worried because a new report found nearly two-thirds of coral in one section of the reef have died after bleaching earlier this year. Our reporter Jackson Worthington has been talking to people who live along the reef about what's going on.
We see manta rays. We get to spend some time in the water with some sharks as well. So we have a specific place which is a grey reef shark cleaning station, which is really, really unique. And we also spend time in the water with tiger sharks.
Don't forget turtles.
Sorry, and turtles. I forget turtles.
Ayler and Fraser usually spend their days on the boat doing tours off the coast of Coral Bay. Ayler is a deckhand and photographer, and Fraser is her boss.
We also actually get loggerhead turtles on an area we call the sand flat. So we have a resident we call Albert.
Coral Bay is about 12 hours north of Perth, and it's considered one of the southern gateways to the Ningaloo Reef. The Ningaloo is a World Heritage listed reef, which is renowned for its animals like whale sharks and manta rays. But lately, it's been making headlines for a different reason.
This marine heatwave it's like an underwater bushfire raging along the Western Australian coast.
Earlier this year, a marine heatwave hit the reef. It caused mass coral bleaching. Coral bleaching happens when reef systems are put under too much stress. Essentially, the coral expels the algae, which gives them colour, causing them to turn white. Large parts of the reef were impacted by what some called an underwater bushfire. In Coral Bay, Ayla and Fraser watched firsthand as the corals turned white. Now, about 6 months after the heatwave, they're watching the colour come back. And they want people to know it's important they still come and visit.
A lot of the science research, we couldn't do it without tourism.
But 2 hours north of Coral Bay, off the coast of Exmouth, the situation looks pretty dire.
I wish I had good things to say, but unfortunately, yeah, we have seen quite a steep decline in the health of the reef since the bleaching.
Brooke Pike is an underwater photographer and tour operator who lives in Exmouth. She spends a lot of time diving the reef.
I think I speak for a lot of people here who feel like the reef is a part of them, and seeing it suffer like this is very shocking, and I feel like it's just not getting the attention it deserves.
The reality on the reef is really different in Coral Bay and Exmouth, but people in both towns want more done to protect it.
I often feel like the Ningaloo is very out of sight, out of mind. This does get swept under the rug quite easily.
If we don't have policies in place to manage what people do in terms of pollution and fishing, which are the two big ones, then we're not giving the reef the best chance to recover.
Our primary tool is marine parks.
Dr. Tom Holmes is the program leader of the marine science team at the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions in WA. His team monitors the health of marine ecosystems right along the WA coast. They usually survey areas once every 3 years, but made an extra trip to the Coral Coast this year after the marine heatwave.
It's been a tough year, I think, for everyone who either lives in these locations or, you know, like myself, who have spent a large period of their life studying it and visiting it on a very regular basis. But you can't turn up to work every day and do this without having a degree of hope for the future.
Dr. Holmes reckons the heatwave that hit the Ningaloo this year is worse than anything that has hit the Great Barrier Reef of Queensland. He says it's hard to know how long the reef will take to recover, particularly if there are more heating events.
You're talking minimum 10 years to get something that might even vaguely resemble what was previously there following a significant bleaching event.
So could this impact the Ningaloo's World Heritage status?
It is definitely a concern because, you know, the coral reef environments are one of the values that gave it its World Heritage status. I don't think we're yet at a point, you know, where we're starting to have to defend its status. You know, Ningaloo has some amazing and incredibly unique attributes to it that make a unique place.
Jackson Worthington reporting there. And we did ask the WA Environment Minister about concerns the government isn't doing enough to protect the reef. In response, a government spokesperson said the government acknowledges climate change is the biggest long-term threat to the Ningaloo Reef. And that's why it has committed $10 million to the restoration of seagrass and coral in the area. The spokesperson said the government takes UNESCO's rating concerns seriously and that it will continue rigorous monitoring of the reef. Let's now head to the other side of the country, to the world's largest coral reef, the Great Barrier Reef. As the 6th annual Great Reef Census is underway, people all over the world are analysing coral along the Queensland coast via photos and with the help of AI. And the participation of these citizen scientists is more important than ever, as conservation funding is becoming harder to find. Connor Byrne has the story.
This one here, that's boulder coral. That one could be branching coral.
In this regional New South Wales school, students in science class are poring over thousands of images of coral. They may not know it, but the work they do in the classroom, classifying thousands of images of coral from the Queensland coast, could help save the Great Barrier Reef. It's the fifth year that pupils at Camden Haven High School have participated in the Great Reef Census, under the eyes of science teacher Dr. Deb Geronomy.
I'm hoping that they will learn from what they're doing in the classroom and take that into their everyday lives, even once they've left school.
Threats from the reef's health from warming ocean temperatures, rising sea levels and water pollution are not new. However, efforts to protect the natural wonder have taken a heavy blow recently, as has the entire global conservation sector, from sweeping cuts to aid funding from the United States. It's estimated this year's cuts to US aid alone put at risk more than $500 million in annual funding for global biodiversity programs.
It was a surprise when the USAID budget was pulled in the way that it was. It was like that, it was off. But it hasn't just been the US. There's geopolitical chaos going on at the moment, but there are knock-on effects in places where most people are not seeing them. But they are real and they're massive.
The Great Reef Census is the brainchild of Queensland NGO Citizens of the Great Barrier Reef. CEO Andy Ridley says while the Citizen Science Project doesn't rely on USAID funding, the census can be performed at a low cost. The organisation has written a new impact report which details how the White House decision from earlier this year has left conservationists worldwide scrambling for alternative funding sources.
There is a need for a disruption to how we look at conservation and how we think about the role of people.
Artificial intelligence has emerged as a key tool for conservation. It can take an expert 9 minutes to analyse a single image of coral on their own, but that is reduced to just 43 seconds with the help of AI. Technologist Aruna Kularu had never even seen a reef when she coded the AI that has allowed the reef census to dramatically grow in scale.
We are able to monitor much more than what has been done earlier, the number of reefs, and this gives the marine scientists or the conservationists an opportunity to intervene.
As the 6th Great Reef Census gets underway, the program is expanding to reefs overseas, including Hawaii and the Red Sea, with further interest from Southeast Asia and the Caribbean.
If you're one of the big organizations that's relied on government money, you've got to be careful to not go into battle against governments because you want that tap to get turned on again.
The next step is to teach the AI model to differentiate between hard and soft and bleached and unbleached corals. Mr. Ridley says while AI has expanded the reef census's ability to cover more ground, the program's 15,000 worldwide citizen scientists are still crucial to its success.
We should never discount the role of people. I think people are incredibly adaptable, useful and valuable in terms of what we're doing. When people have seen reefs and they've seen what happens on reefs, they are the advocates for the reef as well. People fall in love with these places. you know, I have.
Mr. Ridley said young people were still the quickest and most accurate at analysing coral images. Back at Camden Haven High, Lawson Cooper has his own reasons for wanting to ensure the Great Barrier Reef survives.
I'm interested in fishing, and I feel like without reefs, we're not going to have all the variety of fish to catch and have fun chasing.
Lawson Cooper, ending that report from Cairns reporter Connor Byrne.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
Like, say the swimming carnival, I can tell them about how, like, the races are. And as well, there's a big carnival, like, where we show our house colours.
You've never done that before?
No, not really.
The economic toll wreaked by a succession of natural disasters on the northern rivers over the past 5 years has been calculated by Deloitte Economics. It's the first time a multi-disaster economic assessment has been undertaken for a region in Australia. Our reporter Hannah Ross has been looking at this. Hannah, can you talk us through what this report reveals about the impact of disasters on the northern rivers economy?
This is quite a weighty volume. It's 100 pages looking into all aspects of the recovery and the economics of that, as you say, in relation to three separate disasters, which were bushfires in 2019, floods in 2022, and Cyclone Alfred, which hit our region just earlier this year. So it has revealed a big hole in the local economy, $6.9 billion in socioeconomic costs from those three disasters. But they have mentioned a surprise, and the surprise is that the region's economy has tracked the same or 0.1% lower than other parts of regional New South Wales for the same period. So Deloitte Access Economics was commissioned to do this report by the New South Wales Reconstruction Authority as a, you know, comprehensive assessment of how the disaster has affected the region's people and infrastructure and future development. So let's hear now from the partner, David Rumbens.
We estimate it's been $6.9 billion impact across the three events referenced. That includes significant impacts to business at the time, but also longer-term impacts as well to mental health and including the impacts on development of younger people over time. There was certainly a hit through these natural disaster events, but the region has recovered. Now, that recovery has been supported by both government money and by private sector activity, so the residents and businesses of the region. So the most recent event that we profiled, the impact of ex-tropical cyclone Alfred, it was a shorter recovery period, so it kind of indicates that two things. I mean, that event was perhaps of less magnitude than some of the others, but also that investment that's taken place in greater preparedness has perhaps started to pay off.
That's Deloitte Access Economics partner David Rumbens there. Okay, so why is this important to get to the bottom of this? What's important about this data?
Well, look, this data is being used to really feed into the disaster adaptation process in this region. That sort of information is fed into businesses, homeowners, and, the recovery of public assets. You know, any business who's recovering from a disaster is going to be looking at whether, you know, they stay in that disaster prone area or they decide to move on. But, you know, we have to remember that the context of this economic situation for the Northern Rivers is that in the past 5 years, billions of dollars in federal and state government money, you know, has gone into this region. So economically, yes, businesses are, you know, picking themselves up and getting back on their feet, but there is this massive influx of money from the government.
Okay, it's almost 4 years since the big floods of 2022. How do people working in the region feel the economy is tracking now?
Well, since particularly the 2022 floods, there's been a massive move by businesses to really adapt to the new climate conditions that they are potentially facing. So I would say the businesses that were in a, you know, good position prior to those floods have had the ability to sort of pick themselves up and move forward with that sort of adaptation in mind. You know, these are the people who have a connection to the region, their family businesses that have run for, you know, potentially a few generations. So they have that commitment to trying to make it work. But some businesses have also moved into the region. The local cinema in Lismore was completely decimated by flooding in 2022, and a Sydney-based developer has seen an opportunity there to come into the region and renovate and move into that business as an ongoing concern. So I mentioned earlier, the government funding could be seen to be propping up this region, but these are businesses who are feeling confident that and are moving towards the time when that, you know, that funding dries up, and they're feeling quite optimistic about the prospect of standing on their own two feet when the region has, I guess you could say, in inverted commas, recovered, and that government support is no longer there.
So what have you heard from the community? What have small business operators been telling you?
It's encouraging. I'm hearing how it's encouraged that businesses are feeling supported, I guess, from authorities and the local councils, but they're really banding together. I mean, Lismore Chamber of Commerce, for instance, has been working on a plan that means that, you know, should the next flood come, they're all in contact with each other. There'll be trucks ready to go. There'll be a warehouse at Higher Ground so that when disaster strikes, it's not that sudden panic with people being, you know, left to fend for themselves. So they're working on that sort of community action that means that everyone's looked after together. So, I mean, time will tell when the next flood hits, but I know that people are starting to feel more confident and less fearful, I suppose, of the next natural disaster, because this is a region that has been identified as one of the most disaster-prone in Australia. So I think people are recognising that and feeling like it's time to work together to ensure next time it happens, it won't be quite as bad. Andrew Bell runs a blueberry company that's been a big employer in this region for many years. They have decided to keep their operations down in one of the most flood-prone areas of Lismore, which is South Lismore. And here's why he's committed to staying there.
We moved to the South Lismore packing shed in 2021. It had never flooded there before. It was never meant to flood there. Unfortunately, in 2022, it did flood. And so all of our high-tech packing equipment was wiped out. Phase one was to rebuild that equipment, get it back up to food grade. Phase two was to protect that piece of infrastructure, which we did with a custom-built flood panel solution, which is kind of like a fish tank out of the US. So that facility is now completely flood-proof. And then phase three was looking at you know, how we move forward into the future and face the impacts of climate change and weather variability. So, you know, we breed new varieties. So we've started breeding in other locations, and the varieties we breed up there, you know, in the north of Australia might one day be relevant down here in the Northern Rivers. Having grown up in the area, Lismore's, you know, a part of our family and what we do. And so if we can, we'd rather not leave. I think it's really important that people do stay and invest in the region. I love coming into Lismore. It's a melting pot of people from all backgrounds coming together, and it's such a wonderful thing to be a part of. But then ultimately it does come down to dollars and cents, and it was a lot cheaper to go with the flood-proofing solution. I would rather not have gone through that, but it's always good to take the opportunity to stop and reflect on things. And floods is just one of the challenges we face. We have had periods of drought, so we've responded with large storage dams. We've had fires, so making sure, you know, our maintenance around the farms is in good shape. So, you know, it's a good opportunity to reflect and plan for the future.
That's Northern Rivers blueberry farmer Andrew Bell there, and we've been chatting to our reporter in Lismore, Hannah Ross. Hannah, thanks so much for speaking to us here on Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to four times a year, a death adder.
Just, see how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
Let's head to North Queensland, where about 60 Aboriginal artefacts dating back 170 years have been excavated in the outback after being discovered peeking through the red dirt on the land of the Min Min Lights. Researchers say they tell a story of trade and ingenuity. It's only the second time a bundle of historical tools this size has been found in Australia. Mount Isa reporter Maddie Nixon has more.
Oh, it was a very exciting discovery. You know, it's what the ancestors had left behind. And so we didn't know what was there until we started removing all the soil and there were 60 chulas.
Teetering on the edge of the vast Simpson Desert, Pitta Pitta woman Trevina Rogers travels across her country searching for the hidden knowledge of her ancestors.
I've been working with the archaeologists for many years, tracking different things down, like things on country and documenting huts and lots of other things. Very exciting.
Just outside of Boulia in northwest Queensland, a group of archaeologists have been working with local Pitta Pitta people when they found a mysterious cluster poking out of the ground.
They'd been there before about a year ago and they hadn't seen anything because it was all covered in sand. But because floods have gone through, it had just uncovered these stone tools.
Sensing it was significant, they called in their colleague, Dr. Yinnika Purston, an archaeologist and research fellow at Griffith University who specialises in stone tools.
And as soon as they saw it, they knew it was something special. We knew the floods were coming, and once the floods came, they'd wash this site away. So we talked with the Pitta Pitta and they agreed that it'd be better to excavate it than to leave it there and get washed away. They just looked like shiny little stones eroding out of the ground. There was maybe about eight of them. But we could tell that they were stone tools that someone had made there. And because they were all clustered together, we thought maybe it might be a deliberately buried bundle of tools. And so we put in an archaeological excavation, a trench, carefully dug down. And as we dug down, we found that it was this big bundle of 60 stone tools. They're called tula adzes.
A tula is a stone tool used in woodworking, making objects such as boomerangs, coolerman dishes, shields and clapsticks. Professor Bryce Barker from the University of Southern Queensland told the ABC it was very unusual to find so many unused tula adzes in one location stored together as a cache, and this discovery was a significant find. The Griffith researchers say it's only the second time an historic bundle of this size has been found in Australia. The first was found in 1988, also near Boulia.
Even though these tools are found and used pretty much all over Australia, it just so happens that that other bundle is only 7 kilometres away from where we found this one.
Dr. Purston hypothesised the cache of tulas were likely buried by local Pitta Pitta people for future trading.
Someone or a group of people, they had deliberately dug a hole into the ground, they'd put the tulas inside of it, and then they'd covered it up again. They were found near the township of Boulia, and that was on this massive known trade network that the Aboriginal people had when the Europeans arrived. And that trade network, it stretched all the way up, like the Gulf of Carpentaria, all the way down to South Australia. Different groups of people were trading along this. And so someone's buried 60 of them in one spot in a place that's known to be on a trade route. So it might be that they were preparing for trade.
The age of the tulas was determined using a scientific dating technique called optically stimulated luminescence, or OSL.
So the tulas in this case, they are approximately 170 years old. There's a bit of a margin of error in that. So we had an OSL specialist who was with us, and she was able to collect some of the quartz grains from inside of the buried bundle. So in amongst the stone artifacts, there was little grains of quartz from the sand in the soil. And she is able to take these back to her laboratory and estimate the last time they were exposed to sunlight. So we had to excavate them at night time so that they wouldn't get contaminated with modern sunlight. And from this, she was able to tell that the last time those grains of quartz saw the sun was roughly 170 years ago.
Ms. Rogers hopes the discovery will not only bring pride to the Indigenous people in the Northwest, but to all locals.
Yeah, they're interested. They're interested in the history and the knowledge and, like, passing on the knowledge, talking about it, and education is the key to everything.
The future home of the tools is still to be decided, but one thing's for certain, Ms. Rogers is determined to keep looking for answers on country.
I'd like them to be cased in Pitter Pitter, in Boolya. I'd love to see them there on a display, but at the moment they're still looking in and doing different things that they can do with them, and it'll never stop. You know, I'll be still out on country, still looking, still finding new things, discovering things, and seeing how things work. That's the only way to find out, passing the knowledge on.
That's Pitter Pitter Woman, Trevina Rogers, finishing that story from Maddie Nixon.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And finally here on Australia Wide. On the Indian Ocean territory of Christmas Island, dogs have been banned for years to protect its rare and endangered native wildlife. But one Labrador has found herself marooned there, crowned as the remote community's last ever dog. Alastair Bates went to meet her.
Come on, come here.
Yeah.
A chocolate Labrador is an unlikely castaway on Christmas Island. So when 5-year-old Shiloh walks down the street, heads turn.
School kids coming out, going off to school, just... I hear this little voice in the distance, Shiloh! Not Tanya, Shiloh! It's become a bit of a routine now in the morning to walk with Shiloh to school. We have a small crowd of kids that come along.
Feral dogs were eradicated from the remote territory years ago, and strict biosecurity laws have blocked the arrival of any domestic dogs since. But support coordinator Tanya Schoenwald says Shiloh is an exception.
She came up as an assistance dog for someone with a disability to the island, and at the time was the only dog, well, still is the only dog on island, and she caused quite a stir.
Tanya is Shiloh's de facto caregiver. That's because when Shiloh's owner moved back to the mainland, expensive relocation costs and lengthy quarantine rules meant she was left behind. Her work isn't finished, though.
I've recognised that there's a real need on the island as far as emotional support animals, and Shiloh fits that bill. She's got that training. So now we have a community roster where people who are interested will book in a time and take her for a walk. It might last for a few hours, it might last only half an hour. Some people on the weekend take her for the morning, and she goes off and has fun with people and gets lots and lots of love. And she gives lots and lots of love too.
Retiree Nisha Copley is one of Shiloh's most frequent dog walkers.
Where's your stick? You're not showing off your best side, are you?
Today, they've gone for a game of fetch at the beach.
We've always had dogs. I guess the unconditional love, even that we don't know her, yet she'll sit here with us, she cuddles up to you, she gives you those big eyes. Just feels super, super lucky to be able to be trusted with this beautiful girl.
Shiloh also pays regular visits to the Christmas Island Senior Citizen Centre. Where a community elder by the name of Uncle Tan spoils her rotten.
Monday's a special day for Uncle because he gets to see Shiloh. Uncle, he is the famous dog man on Christmas Island because you used to have 7 dogs, but sadly they all had to be shipped off to Malaysia.
Ratu Razad runs the centre. She says Shiloh brightens their days.
This is the only opportunity that the seniors have to see Shiloh when she comes up. It's definitely a great thing when Shiloh comes to visit us because it really does brighten your mood, doesn't it, Uncle? It's great for your mental health. Isn't it, Uncle? How does it make you feel, Uncle?
Happy.
Very happy.
This so-called community dog is likely to be the last of her kind on Christmas Island. In recognition of Shiloh's special job, she's been granted one-off amnesty by local authorities. Tanya Schoenwald says Shiloh isn't going anywhere.
Not if I can help it, or a few other families on island. So I think she's becoming a favourite, more than just a chicken. You know, there's only so many cuddles you can get out of a chicken, but Shiloh you can cuddle endlessly. So I think she's well and truly entrenched here. I just expect her to continue to work with the community. That's what her job is. She works with the community and gets to have lots of fun and hugs.
Alastair Bates with that story. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.